Thank you. Good afternoon or good morning to those of you on the West, and welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Jennifer Simone, and I'll be moderating today's seminar. Today's topic is surface freight transportation responsibilities. Who does what? Please be advised that today's seminar is being recorded. Today we'll have three presentations given by John Steinhoff of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, Jim Pugh of the Maritime Administration, and Barbara Pelletier of the Federal Railroad Administration. John Steinhoff is the policy advisor to the Deputy Administrator of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. He has had a 33-year career with the Department of Transportation, with virtually all of it focused towards commercial motor vehicle safety issues. During his career, he has held senior leadership positions in both headquarters and the field, including 9 years as Regional Director, Field Administrator, based in Baltimore, Maryland. Jim Pugh is the Director of the Office of Marine Highways and Passenger Services at the Maritime Administration. In that capacity, he is responsible for increasing the use of America's coastal and inland waterways to relieve congestion, improve air quality, and increase safety. Prior to joining the Maritime Administration, he was Deputy Division Chief of the Domestic Ports Division based at U.S. Coast Guard Headquarters. He was also the Coast Guard Program Manager for Marine Transportation System Recovery. He has over 30 years of broad experience in ports, shipping, and international trade. This experience includes being the Port Director in San Diego, Houston, and Indiana. He was also president of America's Marine Express, an innovative container ship service between Memphis and Central America. His professional consulting experience in transportation logistics covers projects throughout the world. He has been an active leader in the transportation industry for many years and has served in numerous leadership positions, including vice chairman of the American Association of Port Authorities. He is certified in transportation logistics and registered to practice before the Federal Maritime Commission. Barbara Pelletier is the Director of the International Program at the Federal Railroad Administration. She has been with FRA since 1978, holding a variety of positions. Her federal career began in 1973 with the Federal Highway Administration, where she was a social science analyst involved with the Highway Noise Study. In 1975, she joined the Federal Transit Administration, formerly known as UMTA. There she held the position of Transportation Representative and was responsible for directing and managing activities related to the Capital Grant, Loan, and Operating Assistance Programs. She joined FRA in 1978 as a Program Analyst working with the Local Rail Service Assistance Program. In 1983, she transferred to the Office of Policy of FRA. There she worked on various projects including FRA's Strategic Plan, the Customer Service Program, and Operation Respond. She was a member of the Secretary of Transportation's Y2K team, responsible for outreach to the rail industry, and she had the opportunity to plan, develop, and implement a first-time World Railways Congress. I'd now like to go over a few logistical details prior to starting the seminar. Today's seminar will last about 90 minutes, with 60 minutes allocated for the presentations and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentations you think of a question, you can type it into the smaller text box underneath the chat area on the lower right side of your screen. Please make sure you are typing in the thin text box and not the large white area. Please also make sure you send your question to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. The presenters will not be answering the questions during their presentations, but I'll start off the question and answer session with the questions typed into the chat box. Once we get through all of the questions that have been typed in, the operator will give you instructions on how to ask a question over the phone. If you think of a question after the seminar, you can send it to the presenters directly, or I encourage you to use the Freight Planning Listserv. The listserv is an email list and a great forum for the distribution of information, as well as a place where you could post questions to find out what other subscribers have learned in the area of freight planning. If you haven't joined the listserv, the web address at which you can register is on the slide on the screen. Again, I'd like to remind you the session is being recorded. A file containing the audio and the visual portion of the seminar will be posted to the Talking Freight website within the next week or so. We encourage you to direct others in your office who may have not been able to attend the seminar to access the recording. The PowerPoint presentations used during the seminar are available for download from the file download box in the lower right corner of your screen. The presentations will also be available for download. will also be available online, and I'll notify all attendees of the availability of the PowerPoints, the recording, and the transcript. So we're now going ahead and get started. Today's topic, for those of you who just joined us, is surface freight transportation responsibilities. Who does what? Our first presentation will be given by John Steinhoff of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. As a reminder, if you have any questions during the presentation, please type them into the chat box and they'll be answered during the end of the seminar. So John, I'm going to bring up your presentation. And whenever you're ready, you can get started.
All right, very good. Hi, everybody. Thanks for the opportunity to provide an an overview of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. I put together just a quick PowerPoint to guide us through this, and let me start with this slide here. FMCSA is a safety regulatory agency whose primary mission is to reduce crashes, injuries, fatalities, and property damage involving large trucks and buses. Fatalities, injuries, and property damage from truck and bus-related crashes on our highways cost this nation about $60 billion every year. Now, FMCSA does not have a direct role in developing or implementing freight policy. Rather, we work to ensure that all transportation of freight by truck is done safely. FMCSA sets safety standards for the motor carrier industry, covering areas such as driver qualifications, the number of hours a driver can drive and work, vehicle maintenance, driver licensing, drug and alcohol testing, and minimum levels of insurance. FMCSA is one of 12 agencies within the department and one of three agencies in the department that's focused on improving highway safety. We were formed as a modal administration within the Department of Transportation on January 1st, 2000. Prior to the year 2000, the federal government's motor carrier safety programs were part of the Federal Highway Administration. And then prior to the creation of the Department of Transportation in 1967, the Motor Carrier Safety Program was part of the Interstate Commerce Commission. FMCSA currently has about 1,100 federal employees who are supported by approximately 600 contractors. Most of our staff, about 825 people, work in field offices in each of the states, the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, and the remainder, approximately 275 people, work in headquarters. If you'd like to get more information about the location of our offices, I suggest that you visit our website at www.fmcsa.dot.gov. I did write the website address on my very last slide of this presentation. You'll note that we have 330 investigators deployed around the country. Now, these investigators perform very comprehensive investigations on motor carriers, either truck or bus companies, involved in crashes or exhibiting other unsafe behaviors, such as having high percentages of their vehicles declared unsafe during state roadside inspections, which are often conducted at weigh stations throughout the country. Now, these investigations can and often do result in significant penalties against the companies that we are investigating. We also have about 150 border inspectors who are deployed along the southern border with Mexico. They ensure that commercial vehicles entering the U.S. are mechanically sound and the drivers possess required safety credentials. The border states also deploy significant numbers of border inspectors, about 345 state inspectors at last count. Within DOT, we coordinate our truck and bus safety efforts with other modal administrations, including Federal Highway, which, as you know, focuses on this nation's highway infrastructure, including size and weight limitations for commercial motor vehicles. We coordinate with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which develops the commercial motor vehicle manufacturer standards that the manufacturers of the CMVs must meet. NHTSA also develops safety initiatives such as alcohol and safety belt usage by drivers. We coordinate with the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. PHMSA, they develop the hazardous materials regulations which are applicable to the motor carrier industry and which we enforce to that industry. And then we also coordinate with the Federal Railroad Administration, which works with FHWA on railroad grade crossing issues. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this chart, but I just wanted to give you a sense of who FMCSA is. We are organized by function, which is a traditional structure for a federal agency. People often don't appreciate the size and complexity of the industry that FMCSA regulates. There are approximately 715,000 interstate and foreign-based truck and bus companies registered with FMCSA. The trucking company part of it, they operate approximately 8.8 million large trucks. Trucks carry about 80% of the value of all goods shipped in the U.S. Within the 715,000 motor carrier population, there are approximately 3,700 interstate motor coach companies that operate about 32,000 motor coaches. And then each year, motor coaches travel about 2 billion miles, transporting well over 600 million passengers. The truck and bus industries employ approximately 10 million people, and FMCSA has jurisdiction over 7 million commercial truck and bus drivers, both CDL and non-CDL drivers. Non-CDL drivers are drivers that operate commercial motor vehicles with a gross vehicle weight rating between 10 to 26,000 pounds. There are also quite a large number of foreign-based motor carriers that operate into the United States. There are about 23,000 Canadian truck and bus companies that operate into the United States. And there are about 7,100 Mexican carriers with active authority to operate into the U.S. commercial zones that are along the southern border with Mexico. Let me just say a few words about FMCSA's jurisdiction. In general, we regulate from the safety perspective the interstate and foreign operation of commercial motor vehicles that weigh more than 10,000 pounds, are used to transport more than 15 passengers, or transport hazardous materials in a quantity that requires the vehicles to be placarded. FMCSA generally does not regulate the operation of commercial motor vehicles in intrastate commerce. In other words, transportation wholly within a single state. However, our state partners apply identical or similar safety regulations to this population under the auspices of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration's Motor Carrier Safety Assistance Program, called MCSAP. FMCSA also applies through the state's commercial driver's license requirements for operators of CMVs with a gross vehicle weight rating of more than 26,000 pounds or CMVs designed to transport more than 15 passengers. These licenses are often called CDLs, and these requirements also apply to purely intrastate operations. I'll say just a couple more words on our partnership with the states in a couple of minutes. This slide shows the growth of the motor carrier industry, the red line, and the good progress being made in reducing the rate of fatalities involving commercial motor vehicles, which is the blue line. In the year 2007, we met our goal of 0.175 fatalities per 100 million vehicle miles traveled, where we achieved a rate of 0.170 fatalities. Preliminary estimates indicate that we're going to have a further decline in the year 2008. Note the steady increase in the number of truck and bus companies since the economic deregulation of the motor carrier industry in the 1980s. In the mid-1980s, there were approximately 300,000 interstate motor carriers registered with FMCSA. By 2000, that number was about 600,000 interstate motor carriers, and now there are over 700,000 interstate motor carriers registered with FMCSA. And although the world is currently going through a significant economic slowdown, you know, experts are still projecting that freight volume will continue to increase over the next 20 years, and we expect the motor carrier population to follow that upward trend as well. In calendar year 2007, 41,059 people died in highway crashes, a drop of 1,583 deaths compared to 2006, and these would be all types of highway crashes. From 2006 to 2007, the number of people killed in large truck crashes, they declined from 5,027 to 4,808. which is a decline of about 4.4% decrease. The number of people killed in bus crashes declined from 337 to 322, a 4.5% decrease. Since the agency's creation in 2000, the fatality rate for crashes involving large trucks has declined by 13%. And while we're pleased with all these decreases in fatalities, still, however, trucks are overrepresented in fatal crashes. In 2007, large trucks represented only about 4% of registered vehicles. They accounted for about 7% of the actual travel volume on the highways. But when you look at the number of people killed in motor vehicle crashes, 12% died in crashes involving a large truck. So compared to their prevalence, large trucks are still overrepresented in fatal crashes. Here's a quick snapshot of how FMCSA uses the funds appropriated by Congress. The key takeaway here is that the majority, 92.5% of the agency's budget is invested in federal and state safety programs to reduce large truck and bus crashes. I'd like to just say, talk just a bit about FMCSA's compliance and enforcement programs. I'm going to start at the bottom of this pyramid and work my way up. Given the fact that we have a regulated motor carrier population of over 700,000 companies, and then keeping in mind that we only have 330 investigators visiting each company to ensure compliance with the safety regulations is not practical. So we focus our enforcement resources on the carriers with the greatest risk of a crash. One of our top priorities are new truck and bus companies entering the industry, because data show that their crash rates are higher than those of companies that have been in the industry and operating for a long period of time. We are currently conducting approximately 40,000 new entrant audits each year, and these audits occur within the first 18 months that a company is in operation. We use the data from about 3 million roadside inspections conducted annually. Most of those inspections are done by our state partners. And then we combine this information with crash data to identify high-risk carriers, and then we prioritize those carriers for compliance reviews. During a compliance review, a federal or state official meets on-site with the company's management. We review records and files and other documentation to determine the effectiveness of the company's safety management controls. In 2007, FMCSA and its state partners, we conducted over 16,000 compliance reviews. The compliance reviews may result in penalties for violations, may result in a follow-up review on the company, particularly those that receive less than a satisfactory rating. And then potentially, if the violations are severe enough and there's a severe lack of safety management controls, we can issue out-of-service orders, basically shutting down the company. Technology is an effective tool for improving CMV safety. We are working with the trucking industry to test and evaluate, and also to encourage the use of advanced safety technology such as lane departure warning systems, electronic stability control systems, and adaptive cruise control. Many of the U.S. fleets that have invested in these safety technologies have experienced great success with significant reductions in the number of crashes, and along with that, the significant reduction in the costs associated with these crashes. FMCSA presently is changing the way it does its business. We have a program going on called Comprehensive Safety Analysis 2010, or CSA 2010. This is a major FMCSA initiative to improve the effectiveness of our compliance and enforcement programs. When fully implemented, CSA 2010 will allow us to assess the safety performance of many more truck and bus companies than the 40,000 new entrant companies and the 16,000 through the compliance review. So we're going to hit a lot more of these companies, the system will also allow us to intervene to address problems as soon as they become apparent. We're going to be applying a wide range of interventions, from warning letters to assessment of penalties. If you'd like more information about this program or, frankly, FMCSA in general, you know, visit our website. Over half of FMCSA funding is provided to our state partners in the form of grants, and FMCSA recognizes that it cannot achieve its safety goals without a successful partnership with each of the states in the area of truck and bus safety initiatives, particularly since a significant number of trucks and buses operate only in a single state. This slide shows the array of grants available to our state partners, and these grants total approximately $300 million. So I recognize I've shot through these slides real quick. Should you have any questions about FMCSA, I recommend that you visit our website. It's there on the screen, and after all the presentations have been done, if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Well, thank you, John. And as John mentioned, we'll get to the questions after all three presentations. We're now going to move on to Jim Pugh of the Maritime Administration. So, Jim, you can go ahead whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to tell you a part of what the Maritime Administration does in surface freight transportation. The reason I'm going to limit is because this is a new program that we feel should be of interest to state DOTs and MPOs and other people. It's called the Immediate Solution, and it's America's Marine Highways. It's the immediate solution to some of the problems we're facing throughout the country with growing congestion, deteriorating air quality in our urban corridors, as well as capacity constraints. The DOT estimates that congestion is now costing the country about $2 billion a year in lost productivity, and I'm sure that those of you that live in the major cities experience that on a daily basis when you're going to and from work. This slide illustrates some of the major rail congestion and bottleneck areas that we're faced with that delay and increase the costs of movement of rail freight around the country. And we have a similar situation with truck bottlenecks. And what the Marine Highways program is trying to do is offer some alternatives for addressing congestion in these areas by substituting a marine transportation system as an extension for the highway and railway network. This is just showing the annual cost of congestion in the various metropolitan areas by size. One of the other major benefits of the Marine Highways program, though, is the reduction in pollutants because of the operating efficiency of marine transportation. I've got a couple slides here to show you how inland towing with barge and tugboat compares to railroads and trucks in particulates, in nitrogen oxide, hydrocarbons, and carbon monoxide. In addition to the reduced congestion, there is also an improvement potential for the movement of hazardous materials. Many of these hazardous materials are currently moving through the urban corridors by truck or railroad, where the risk is substantially higher for some kind of an incident that will affect the population, that it might be moving it by marine transportation. Another benefit of the Marine Highways program, and this slide's a little bit dated, as you can tell, the crude oil price has come down now to around $80 a barrel, but marine transportation is substantially more fuel efficient and thereby reduces some of our reliance on foreign sources of crude oil and petroleum products. This slide shows you the relative efficiency of water transport compared to rail and trucks. And capacity, this is a similar illustration in that one barge tow could handle 456 40-foot trailers or 40-foot containers. That would take 228 rail cars to move, or 456 trucks on the road. And where there are opportunities to move a portion of that distance by water, there are substantial economies to be achieved. Now, this particular slide is showing you the relationship between our trade and prosperity. And the reason this is important is because we are, although we're in a recession right now, we're going to come out of it at some point. And our foreign trade will resume at levels similar to what they were prior to 2007. And as trade increases, our GDP increases. And right now, they're talking about, or the forecasts are, that our foreign trade may double by the year 2020. Now, given the recession that we're in, that could slip for two or three years, but it's still a significant upward trend that's putting more and more pressure on our infrastructure, both highway and railway infrastructure, as well as our port system. Waterway transportation offers a way to take some of that pressure off by having an alternate mode of movement of that freight cargo, at least deferring some of those infrastructure expansions that are quite costly and sometimes politically not feasible. So the capacity solution is the marine highways, when there is a waterway adjacent to one of these major interstate corridors or rail corridors, services can be developed that will move cargo from the rail or highway onto water for a portion of that movement, and substantially reduce the congestion in that corridor, improve the air quality, and move it more efficiently than it can move by rail or highway. We are currently only moving about 2% of our domestic freight by water. As you can see, the Europeans are moving about 44%, and China moves about 61%. Europe in particular has a very, very aggressive program because their highway system is even more constrained than ours. And the European community is developing a program now where they're going to actually provide a rebate of 100 euros to any truck that uses ferries for all or a portion of their trip within the European community. This is just a map that illustrates the America's marine highways. It's all of our coastal waterways, the inland waterways, the intra-coastal canals, and the Great Lakes. And there's currently several services, short sea transportation services, that are operating, and more are being developed all the time. But we need to work closely with the state DOTs and MPOs so that they recognize that this is an immediate solution to some of their problems. And in fact, we just recently inaugurated a couple new services, container and barge service from Norfolk to Richmond, Virginia, and container and barge service from Brownsville, Texas to Port Manatee in Florida. Both of those services are taking a significant amount of truck traffic off of the interstate in those traffic lanes. So the Marine Highways Program, as I mentioned, is a new program. Right now, this is a result of the Energy Independence Act of 2007. But the program is right now got an interim rulemaking out for comment that ends on February the 6th. We're also seeking recommendations from public entities, be they state DOTs or MPOs or municipal governments, for corridor designation, which the Secretary of Transportation will make those designations, and then once a corridor is designated, we will put a call out for marine highway projects to be applied for, and when those are approved in the Maritime Administration, we'll work closely with the project proponents to make sure that we can support them through all the federal efforts, whether that be trying to develop funding for them or working with them to expedite permits or develop the market. Our program is also responsible to identify impediments and solutions, and we are in the process right now of establishing a Marine Highway Advisory Board, which will be a SPACA committee that will look at what impediments there are, such as the harbor maintenance tax on domestic water transport, and what the potential solutions to remove those impediments can be, so that we can work with Congress and the administration to see if we can provide a level playing field and maybe even some incentive to help induce some of the cargo that's moving domestically to move on the marine highway system. And that's pretty much an outline of the program. The final rule, as I mentioned, is the comments are due by the 6th of February. We will then review those comments, make whatever changes we need to the final rule, and publish that hopefully sometime in April. And following that, we'll issue a call for project applications through the Federal Register. As we seek ways to address congestion and air quality and infrastructure capacity in our urban areas, we think that America's marine highways can offer, in some circumstances, an immediate solution to help reduce congestion, improve air quality, and reduce the cost of maintenance on some of the highway infrastructure, and in fact, defer some of the capacity that needs to be added. If we're successful in substituting water transport in some of the major corridors. And that concludes my presentation. I will be available at the end of the presentation to answer any questions. Thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you, Jim. And again, we'll get to questions at the end. We're now going to move on to our final presentation of the day, given by Barbara Pelletier of the Federal Railroad Administration.
Good afternoon, everyone, and it is a pleasure to be here. My presentation will focus on a general overview of the U.S. railroad industry and the Federal Railroad Administration, what we do and who we are. Federal Railroad Administration's organization, we are headed by an administrator who is appointed by the president with Senate confirmation. We have five offices under there, the largest of which is our Office of Safety. The Office of Safety employs 450 rail safety inspectors in regions throughout the United States. I'm a member of our Office of Policy and Communications. These are the regions throughout the United States. As I mentioned earlier, there are eight regions, each with a regional administrator and deputy administrator. FRA's mission is to promulgate and enforce rail safety regulations. We administer railroad financial assistance programs. We conduct research and development in support of improved rail safety. We develop the National Rail Transportation Policy, and we administer grant agreements to Amtrak. As such, the Department of Transportation has a seat on Amtrak's Board of Directors that is generally designated to the administrator of the Federal Railroad Administration. Just some general statistics about the U.S. rail industry, just to give you a sense of its magnitude. U.S. rail industry has 140,000 plus miles of track. They own 23,732 locomotives, 1.3 million rail freight cars, with a 99 average ton per carload. There are over 186,000 railroad workers. Of those, 168,000 are Class 1, work for the Class 1 railroads. 2 billion ton miles of freight carried each year. 32.1 million freight cars are originated. 52.2 billion in annual operating revenue, with an 11.3% rate of return on shareholders' equity, which of course is a statistic that generally has the railroads from around the world very fascinated and interested in how the U.S. railroad industry works. They've not seen such rate of returns on their equity. This is a map indicating rail density throughout the United States. As you can see, coal is our number one commodity, and the bulk of our coal originates up there in Wyoming at the Powder River Coal Basin. And you can see the heavy flows from there going both east and west. There's also quite significant traffic moving from the West Coast ports into the East Coast. Okay, in comparison to the rest of the world, the United States carries far more freight than any other railroad. However, in contrast, we carry next to no passengers. As you know, Europe and Asia, the passenger rail service is very significant. You can see China leading the world, followed very closely by India and Japan. And if you think of the land mass in Japan and look at the passengers carried versus the United States, you can see where we are not ranking very high in comparison to railroads around the world. The railroads carry 42% of the market share. And again, this is breakdown of commodities carried by the railroads, with coal being the number one commodity. I have to say, though, the fastest growing sector of carloads in the United States are the container traffic. And just this year, I believe the intermodal traffic did outpass coal in terms of volume carried. So intermodal traffic is really the number one commodity, as you would have it, in the U.S., followed by coal. This gives an indication of the net investment made by the railroads. As you can see, with the passage of the Staggers Act, and it's with the Staggers Act that the U.S. railroad industry was privatized, freed from the regulations instituted through the Interstate Commerce Commission. That commission was also done away with, and you've got the railroads, because of their profitability, have been able to invest very well in their own infrastructure. U.S. rail staffing, again, as a result of the Staggers Act, has dropped phenomenally over the past few decades. Productivity per rail employee has increased phenomenally. Some of this is attributed to new technology, and actually here's a graph of that. I jumped ahead of myself a little bit. And again, a lot of this is as a result of new technology. Also, the unions are cooperating more with the railroads. Fewer employees are required per train as negotiations pursue. And the Staggers Act, again, freed the railroads far more to compete in the marketplace, set their rates, work with the unions directly without the government intervention. Rail rates, again, as a result of staggers, lack of federal intervention, rail rates have reduced also over the past decade. Talk a little bit about rail, maritime, and intermodalism. This is a little bit older slide. Intermodal traffic is second only to coal. Can't say that anymore. It actually has now surpassed coal. Comparison is in 1980, 3 million trailers and containers were originated. Now in 2005, 11.7 million trailers and containers have originated. Double stack container loads are increasing, and expansion from the Midwest to the Eastern Seaboard. Of course, the advantage of double stacking is you've got one train with a crew of two hauling 200 containers versus the 100 truck drivers and trucks hauling 100 double trailers. This is just a graph indicating the growth in intermodal traffic over the past few decades. It's a phenomenon that we're dealing with in the U.S. is the rapid growth of freight volumes. Obviously, they're growing faster than passenger. So what issues are we facing in the railroad industry? Generally, a question of congestion and capacity. The diagram on the left shows indicates the truck freight flows and commodities. The one on the right indicates the rail freight loads, commodities. What are we looking at in the future? Freight traffic is expected to double by 2020. The population growth and economic growth mean that domestic transportation system will be even further strained. Funding for expansion is not identified. Environmental issues will slow increases in capacity. Something that we need to keep in mind when we talk about railroads. Railroads really receive no federal government support, unlike the highway system and the air system. What are we looking at in terms of freight growth? The rail ton miles have been growing at 3% per year. Intermodal units are growing at almost a rate of 5% per year. The tons carried have increased over 2% a year, and car loading is also at about 2% per year of an increase. Railroads are expanding workforces and infrastructure. The rate of expansion is determined by profitability. Again, if the railroads are going to expand, they are doing any kind of improvements either through technology, through infrastructure, out of their own pocket. The demand for intermodal and coal are key factors. Railroads are reluctant to invest speculatively. Will the demand be there in the future? And railroad profits do not justify rapid increases in capacity. In closing, economic strength and trade relationships will increasingly define global influence in the 21st century, and influence can help guide change. The 16th to the 19th century can be considered an age of locational advantage. The 20th century,
okay,
we encountered and realized an age of competitive advantage.
Early, I can go down there.
The 21st century, I believe we're looking at an age of competitive and collaborative advantage. That concludes my presentation, and I'm open for any questions. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Barbara. We're now going to